climate change the facts? The Scientists and the Apocalypse by Bernie Lewin. Part 2. The Revolt. August 1990 and the conflict in the policy group arrived unresolved in Sundsvall, with Brazil proclaiming its intentions before the fourth full session of the IPCC even began. Disrupting the approval process with novel amendments, they blocked consensus on the synthesis report. As the disheveled proceedings dragged on into the evening of the final day, it seemed a sabotage attempt had succeeded. But in the desperate small hours of the night, Bolin managed to salvage a summary of sorts. This was not the one he had drafted, but mostly a patchwork of extracts from the already approved working group summaries. There were also two novel insertions. One, a disclaimer that the report does not reflect the positions of all participating governments. The other, a declaration that rapid technological transfer is urgently required. An embarrassment to the process, this synthesis was never widely distributed and only ever published 2 years later, behind another report. Never again would the IPCC delve into the fraught domain of policy proposals, henceforth restricting itself to policy-relevant advice. But before it was able to produce another full report, the struggle for control of the policy agenda threatened its very survival. The December 1990 resolution to replace UNEP management of the treaty process with an independent International Negotiating Committee, INC, did still name the IPCC as a source of technical advice. But in the drafting of the FCCC by this committee, this emerged as only an interim arrangement until the, quote, Conference of Parties to the Convention, COP, could establish its own subsidiary body of scientific and technical advice, SBSTA. The purpose of this body would be to provide assessments of the state of scientific knowledge. SBSTA would prepare scientific assessments, and it would respond to any technological questions of the parties. The wording could not be clearer. At the first Conference of Parties meeting, COP1, SBSTA would replace the IPCC. Alive and Walking Frankenstein. As its future was thrown into doubt, the IPCC had another problem, which was in the doubtful advice it continued to provide. Under the interim arrangement in the lead-up to the Earth Summit, and with its policy group languishing in stunned suspension, the IPCC continued to assert its independence by preparing supplements to the assessments of the other two working groups. Added to the top of the Working Group 1 supplement was an updated summary of the science. Its six cautious, quote, major conclusions only showed how little had changed, with the last repeating the prediction that detection is not likely for a decade or more. While the IPCC confirms that it was stuck on basic questions, the INC was writing its equivocations into obsolescence. The Framework Convention on Climate Change, FCCC, opened with a statement that emissions will result in global warming. There seemed to be no need for Working Group 1 to continue its search for empirical confirmation. The FCCC then redefined climate change as only that resulting from human activity. In one stroke, the prior work of the IPCC was reframed to its needs. Not surprisingly, whenever the INC did solicit further advice, it was never to confirm the science, but only ever to inform the development of climate treaty protocols. One such question, perhaps the most basic of all, caused no end of friction between these two UN organizations. The objective of the FCCC was set to, quote, stabilize greenhouse gas concentrations in the atmosphere at a level that would prevent dangerous anthropogenic interference with the climate system. And so the IPCC was asked to provide the level at which such concentrations would become dangerous. But as discussions began, with special workshops convened, Bolin became increasingly preoccupied with the uncertainties engulfing every aspect of this question. The INC kept pressing for an answer, while Bolin shifted toward the view that this was not a question for the IPCC because it was in the realm of policy. While others in the IPCC leadership disagreed, he slipped into further doubt, wondering whether anyone in any sphere could provide a meaningful answer. With so many uncertainties in the relations between chaotic systems, both natural and social, it would be impossible to make a call on where danger lay. Nevertheless, the IPCC pressed ahead with plans for a second full and independent assessment, scheduled for release in 1995. This might have come in before the interim arrangement ended, with COP1 required within a year after reaching a quota of convention ratifications. When this was attained earlier than many expected, in March 1994, the timetable for the second assessment review process had already pushed out to the end of 1995, way beyond COP1 scheduled for that March. Early friction with the INC did not amount to much until 1993, when Raul Estrada Ayala, an Argentinian diplomat, was elected to the chair. In preparing for COP1, at COP1 and beyond, Estrada made it known that Bolin and his IPCC were an annoyance that the treaty process would be better without. After the COP1 date was fixed, Estrada repeatedly asked Bolin to fast-track the new assessment. It was when Bolin deferred a long-planned joint meeting on the, quote, dangerous levels question, that Estrada wondered aloud whether the scientists were suffering from a Dr. Frankenstein syndrome. Their work had created the convention, yet now that it is alive and walking and deciding things, the scientists have reacted against its demands. Were they afraid that their creation is now dangerously out of control? Estrada teased the IPCC with this analogy while visiting the UK, and so new scientists asked the British chairman of Working Group 1, John Houghton, to respond. Houghton defended their tardiness just as Bolin had. The rigorous peer review process needed time to run its course. But anyway, he could see no rush, for the new report would contain little that was new. Quote, the past 4 years' work has underlined and confirmed most of what we said in 1990. That was in June 1994. Early in 1995, COP1 produced the Berlin Mandate and SBSTA. Meanwhile, the IPCC, now in tenuous authority, continued with its assessment. In the summer, Working Group 1 lead authors met for the first time in Asheville, North Carolina, to finalize the chapters and draft the summary. When these were circulated ahead of the approved plenary scheduled for November in Madrid, it was clear that Houghton was right. Not much had changed. Not much except something of a retreat on the question of detection. New research by the lead authors of the detection chapter raised new concerns about determining natural variability from the patchy and uncertain climate record. With inadequate knowledge of natural variability, there was no yardstick against which to measure the human influence. The detection chapter, Chapter 8, closed off with a deeply skeptical conclusion. The retreat to skepticism is completed in the response to the question of when detection might be achieved. Quote, we don't know. The drafted policymaker's summary was not so skeptical, and cheerleading journalists let everyone know by leaking a weak detection claim. With legally binding emissions protocols now a real prospect, there were business interests keen to see it moderated. Everyone was ready for a real showdown in Madrid, and this time the business lobby was well prepared. Scientists against science. Especially following the Rio summit, non-government organizations of all shades had been encouraged to participate in the review process. Opposite Greenpeace, a business coalition that they called, quote, the Carbon Club, had already made a strong case for weakening the summary with a raft of suggested changes built on the very wording of the underlying chapters. At Madrid, they continued the campaign in collaboration with the Saudis. But not long after the meeting opened, they were thrown completely off guard. From the chair, Houghton told the assembled delegates that there had been new positive developments in the science of detection, which the coordinating lead author of Chapter 8, Ben Santer, would explain in an extended presentation. This concluded with Santer announcing that the chapter, as written, was out of date. Then Houghton established a side group to draft an update of the working group's findings. When this procedure was challenged, there was a ruling from the chair. This was challenged again, and Bolin lent his support. A Saudi delegate protested that during his 6-year involvement with the IPCC, the underlying report had always been the authority for the summary. But now it appeared that the rules had changed. Indeed, they had. In the short history of the IPCC, there had always been pressure to bring the report into alignment with some agreement on the floor. But this was always met with strong resistance from the chair. Of course it was Sonsfeld last time around. But even as the Saudis protested in Madrid, there remained an unresolved dispute in the reformed Working Group 3. For the second assessment, this cursed working group was asked to delve into the neglected economic dimensions. Troubled from the beginning, the approved plenary broke down, was reconvened, but the crisis continued over calls to change a chapter. The problem was in the estimations of climate change damages, where the value of a life among the rich was taken as 10 times greater than among the poor, where most deaths were expected. Moreover, devaluing the poor so reduced damages that this was seen to justify the air-conditioned rich doing nothing about their continuing impacts on the rest. This, quote, price of life controversy broke out at COP1, where it exacerbated the rich-poor polarization and embarrassed the IPCC just as its interim advisory role expired. And it would continue even after the Working Group 1 plenary in Madrid, with calls to break the deadlock by chapter changes only met by the author's refusals upheld by the chair. At Madrid, it was a different story. There, the call to break with the science-to-policy process came from the chair. The new developments Santa presented to delegates in Madrid were from his own, recent, and unpublished work. While assessing their implications for the problem of detection just before the lead author meeting in Asheville, Santer said, quote, I don't think this is evidence that we've solved the problem. Far from it. At Asheville, he was not so reticent, and he used a special presentation of his findings to push for a positive detection, quote, bottom line. This met with strong resistance across the 4-day conference and beyond. As a result, the draft summary finalized after Asheville contained a weak detection claim, glaringly inconsistent with other passages, and with Chapter 8's skeptical conclusion. In Madrid, despite further protestations through the mouthpiece of the Saudis, this inconsistency was resolved in favor of detection. After the meeting, the chapter's concluding summary was removed along with the quote, we don't know, and other skeptical statements, thus smoothing the way for the bottom-line detection claim already agreed in Madrid. Quote, the balance of evidence suggests a discernible human influence on global climate. A discernible human influence. However so weak this detection claim, it had enormous impact as the slogan for the treaty talks to take the next step. At COP2, when the USA finally gave way with support for binding emissions protocols, it was presented as a scientific basis for their decision. Had it not got up in Madrid, governments would have faltered on taking urgent action, such as signing in 1997 the Kyoto Protocol. So Houghton later reflected in the prestigious scientific journal Nature under the banner, quote, meetings that change the world. Perhaps only as a convenient rhetorical authority, but its timely provision made a world of difference for the IPCC. By political and media acclaim, detection launched the IPCC back onto center stage, where its role as the permanent scientific advisor to the treaty process passed beyond question. The pretender, SBSTA, was soon reduced to the mere conduit of its advice. But this marvelous renaissance had a dark side. The Carbon Club were none too happy with the way they had been outmaneuvered. Retaliations began as soon as the club got hold of the new version of Chapter 8, the scandal breaking just before COP2. Their case was devastating and difficult to refute, yet passes unsupported within the scientific establishment. All support was for Houghton to dismiss the ongoing protests as merely the wailing of the unrepentant global polluters vanquished by the scientists in Madrid. It was as though the saints of the apocalypse had won a mighty battle to secure our common future. Such heroic resonances might have saved face, but redemption's great price would be paid and paid again, and across the institutions of science. An exceptionally explicit expression of which is a volt face caught freeze-framed in Nature. During 1995, Nature ran numerous embarrassing news stories on the various scandals emerging during the second assessment, including one lead author's refusal to release to a reviewer the modeling data behind a key but dubious graph. Two scathing editorials attacked the IPCC one calling for the first working group to be reined in to a more judicial course while suspending the others. When the Chapter 8 controversy broke, the barrage continued with an editorial in support of the complainant and doubtful about the defense. And yet this time the critique was couched in restraint. Indeed, the main thrust of the editorial was a call for restraint. Its headline imploring, quote, "Climate debate must not overheat." Why? Because these charges against the IPCC, quote, "should not be allowed to undermine efforts to win political support for abatement strategies." Those scientists failing to heed this advice were marginalized and ostracized as traitors to science, unsupported by their academies. Skepticism became intolerable, silence golden. After Madrid, during the late 1990s, energy and chemical companies ran from the Carbon Club to a fully green image. Emboldened scientific institutions saw fit to break their silence, standing up for virtuous science and the common good. Most significant historically was when the president of the oldest state-sponsored empirical science academy, the Royal Society, launched it into the new millennium with a declaration for the cause, thus violating their ancient policy, quote, never to give their opinion as a body. By 2007, the American Physics Society was proclaiming global warming a truth incontrovertible, given that every physicist knows that in empirical science there is nothing beyond challenge. Their declaration was surely the clearest message of all, that what was being defended here was not science but dogma. And so we have it. Starting with a handful of scientists in obscure fields sucked up into the Save the World politics of UNEP, we have now arrived, after only a few short decades, with corruption spread across our great institutions of science. Whether knowingly or not, and whatever their motivation, these scientists opened a gap for huge political forces to overwhelm their principles and processes and to empower those among them willing to participate in the corruption. Climate Change: The Facts is published by Stockade Books. All rights reserved.